And I'm back again to read Hitler's War by David Irving. A test of endurance. How appropriate for me tonight. In Stalin, Hitler unquestionably now knew he had met his match. As the Soviet resistance hardened despite each fresh catastrophe inflicted on its armies, Hitler's admiration for his Bolshevik adversary grew. "This Stalin is obviously also a great man," he told his baffled generals. "To claim anything else would not make sense. Historians of the future will have to set out from the fact that today's events are governed by the collision or collusion of great, towering personalities whose paths cross like this only once in many centuries." So Hitler's admiring Stalin. Not the best image. The Wehrmacht had captured over 3 million Russian prisoners. The Soviet Union had lost most of its aluminum, manganese, pig iron, and coal resources. As soon as Hitler's armies could penetrate beyond Rostov into the Caucasus, Stalin would lose 90% of his oil as well. In Moscow, tens of thousands of people were being evacuated. Some of those who had to stay in the capital tried to obtain swastika flags and German dictionaries in anticipation of the city's capture. But for the first 2 weeks of November, the German armies were held immobile by the mud and more. There were those generals, Erich Hoeppner among them, who bitterly criticized their army superiors for not giving the Panzergruppen their head in the October offensive. This overcautiousness bordering on defeatism had deprived Hoeppner of any chance of destroying all the Russian reserve forces as well. Now these reserves, augmented by workers from the Moscow factories and freshly arrived Siberian divisions, magnificently equipped with winter gear, were pouring into the capital's defenses. Germany had still suffered no military reverses, and this was a position of strength from which Hitler was willing to envisage offering peace terms to the enemy. In early November, Ribbentrop's diplomatic seismographs detected signs that the Führer wanted peace. Etzdorf, Ribbentrop's liaison officer to the general staff, listed them thus. Quote, "Ambassador von Bergen is to be replaced at the Vatican by a more active personality, one better able to monitor the peace possibilities coming through there. Everything relating to peace in the foreign press is to be carefully collected and immediately submitted. The same procedure is to be followed with regard to Russia's domestic situation." End quote. Wiesacker held out no hope of peace, however. He told Halder that there was no evidence that Britain was inclined toward a cessation of hostilities. He felt that any moves initiated by Germany would be rebuffed. By the end of the month, Hitler knew Wiesacker was right. British Foreign Office instructions to ridicule any peace offensive by Hitler reached German hands. "The present peace offensive," this document emphasized, "comes not, as it was intended to do, at a moment of victory over Russia, but when Germany is further away from victory than at any previous time." Hitler reminded one minister arriving in Berlin for the fifth anniversary of the Anti-Comintern Pact that Lord Halifax had once bragged of being a strong enough man to ignore the countless letters from all over England demanding peace in 1940. This was proof, said Hitler, that the Jewish Bolshevik suicidal forces still had the upper hand in London. Wistfully, he added that what irritated him most was that cretin Churchill was interrupting him in his mighty task of cultural reconstruction. For Hitler, the thrills of war-making had long palled, but not for the generals. Halder's private letters came proudly reveled in the advances his army had achieved. Halder commanded Bach's army group to delay its Moscow offensive until the logistics build up would support a far more ambitious offensive. The Ninth Army would lunge far beyond Moscow toward Kalinin, the Volga Reservoir, and Salizharovo. The 3rd and 4th Panzergruppen would make for Vologda, and Guderian's 2nd Panzer Army was even assigned Gorky as its final objective for the winter. Hitler pocketed his doubts and approved the plans. On November 11th, Jodl signed a directive to the army groups setting out that these far-flung ambitions to be achieved before the heavy snowfall begins. I read that wrong, but it means the same thing the way I said it. Halder stoutly defended these aims at a staff conference in Orsha on November 13th, optimistically counting on 6 weeks campaigning before the winter really closed in. Neither Bach nor Rundstedt would hear of such distant objectives, thus a limited advance on Moscow only was finally approved. Had Halder's grand strategy been adopted, Hitler would undoubtedly have lost his entire Eastern Army in the catastrophe that shortly unfolded. In fact, Hitler was on the horns of a dilemma. He had postponed his assault on the main Caucasus oil fields until 1942. By that time, they would probably have been destroyed, but he still showed a curious optimism. Halder wrote, "All in all, he gave an impression of anticipating that when both warring parties realize that they are incapable of destroying each other, there will result a negotiated peace." It was the vision of a second Verdun that kept recurring to Hitler, and the condescending notion that since Stalin had fought well and fearlessly, he should be spared the fate he had no doubt otherwise deserved. There was an odd echo of this attitude in Hitler's remarks to his munitions minister, Fritz Tott, who returned from a tour of the Russian front on November 29, 1941, and summed up his prognosis thus. "Given the arms and industrial supremacy of the Anglo-Saxon powers, we can no longer militarily win this war," Hitler calmly inquired. "How am I supposed to end it, then? I can't see much possibility of ending it politically." Even before Barbarossa, Hitler had realized that German aircraft and tank production was inefficient. The aircraft industry was beset by prima donna personalities and producing a plethora of outdated aircraft. General Ernst Udet, the director of air armament, recognized his share of the blame and shot himself in November. To succeed Udet, Hitler appointed Field Marshal Erhard Milch, Goering's bustling deputy, but it would be in 1943 before Milch's appointment could have any real effect. Tank design was different. Here Hitler considered himself an expert. By November 1941, he feared that the tank's useful offensive life would soon be over. This meant that the panzer divisions would have to complete Hitler's program of territorial conquests quickly, which in turn meant building bigger tanks and in greater quantity than the British or Russians could. The huge Russian tank output had shaken him badly. When Tottenau, on November 29, 1941, told him of two more Russian types that he had examined at Orel, Hitler exclaimed in exasperation, "How can such a primitive people manage such technical achievements in such a short time?" 9 months had passed since Hitler had called his own first tank design symposium at the Berghof on February 18, 1941. Then he had demanded the modification of their tanks to mount much heavier caliber long barrel lead guns, 50 and 75 millimeters respectively. On May 26th, Hitler had demanded an even heavier gun in future tanks and instructed both the Henschel Tank Works and Professor Ferdinand Porsche to produce prototypes mounting the 88mm heavy gun. The Orthodox tank designers were aghast, but Hitler pictured to them the morale and physical effect of a direct hit by such a shell on a cast steel tank turret. It would burst asunder, he said. At their conference on November 29th, Hitler again warned Tott and Brauchitsch that the age of the tank would soon be past. He asked them to concentrate on three basic tank designs: a light tank for reconnaissance, like the present Mark III, a medium tank, the Mark IV, and a heavy tank, the later Panther, to outclass the Russian T-34. In mid-November 1941, Field Marshal von Bock had resumed his drive toward Moscow. His northern wing began to move on the 15th, followed by the southern wing 2 days later. All Hitler's commanders had assured him that the Red Army lacked depth, But the enemy's resistance before Moscow was ominously vehement, and he began to suspect that he had again been wrongly advised. He bluntly told the ailing Field Marshal von Brauchitsch that it was a question of the army's will to victory. Meanwhile, General von Kleist's 1st Panzer Army had managed to seize Rostov on the Don. Temperatures of 14 degrees Fahrenheit gripped the front. The tank engines refused to start, and Reichenau's 6th Army had found comfortable winter quarters, which they were very loath to leave. Ribbentrop came on the 22nd, no doubt to discuss the big demonstration of European solidarity he was about to stage in Berlin. Hitler listened to Ribbentrop's speech on the radio. It was an important address to the ambassadors and foreign ministers of Germany's allies and friendly neutrals. Had the Soviet Union been on the brink of defeat, it would have been timely and well chosen, but Ribbentrop made the British government the butt of his leaden witticisms, goaded by the constant and effective British propaganda charge that he, as Hitler's foreign minister, was to blame for this war. Soon after, Ribbentrop himself phoned, asking if Hitler had liked his speech. The Führer had not, and he was still fulminating against the foreign ministry when his train left headquarters to take him to Berlin at 7 p.m. that evening. In Berlin, a round of receptions for the new signatories of the Anti-Comintern Pact began. They made a curious bunch. The Hungarians had to be kept apart from the Romanians. Ciano was accorded the same frozen politeness as had been his lot on his recent visit to the Wolf's Lair. The Turks, who had also been invited to join the pact, had refused point blank. From decoded British Admiralty telegrams, Hitler knew that Turkey was again playing a double role. Vichy France was not invited to join the pact, as Hitler still evidently hoped to treat with Britain someday at France's expense. A French volunteer legion was now fighting under Bock's command, and from decoded American cables, the Germans knew that Pétain had commended Germany for adhering to the armistice conditions. Hitler had kept his promises, and Pétain accordingly supported his plan for a new order from which he felt that France could only profit. But Hitler's latent resentment had its psychological roots too deep in recent history to be easily overcome. As his surly reply to a letter from the French marshal showed, Hitler said that Germany's recent execution of French communists in reprisal for the assassination of German officers doing their lawful duty was fully justified. The Führer drew a passionate comparison between what he presented as Germany's restrained presence now in France and the French troops' unruly behavior in the Rhineland between the wars, when they had driven the German citizens from the sidewalks with their raiding crops, and the rape of more than 16,000 German women had gone unpunished. A major source of discontent in France was that Germany, like France after World War I, was still detaining over 1 million French prisoners of war. Hitler could not dispense with this labor force, for the German agricultural and armament economy relied heavily on prisoners. So, it's basically a slave economy. Albert Speer, Hitler's chief architect, asked him to provide Russian forced labor for his work in building a new Berlin. Speer lunched with him and showed him the latest scale models of Berlin's new buildings, the vast Great Hall, the office of the Reichsmarshal, and the new stadium. Hitler granted Speer's request for 30,000 Russian prisoners to help in the construction work. The Führer assured Speer that no war was going to keep him from putting these plans into effect. While he was in Berlin on November 27th, Hitler learned that the talks between Japan and the United States had broken down. He now had a private meeting with the Japanese Ambassador General Oshima, who tried unsuccessfully to warn him of the war that was coming. 2 weeks later, Hitler admitted to his staff that he should have paid closer attention to the cautious hints that Oshima dropped. The United States was evidently having second thoughts about fighting a war in Europe. Several American destroyers had recently been sunk by U-boats, but Roosevelt had shown little firm reaction. As late as December 6th, Hitler would be shown dispatches from Hans Thompson, his charge d'affaires in Washington, listing the reasons why the United States would not declare war yet. This firm evidence that Roosevelt now wanted to avoid armed conflict until his rearmament was ready persuaded Hitler that war between the United States and Japan might serve his purposes after all. It would tie this powerful enemy down in the Pacific at least throughout 1942. The German attachés in Tokyo warned Berlin that Japan would enter the war before the year was out, and that Tokyo would shortly approach would shortly approach Germany for a pact binding each country not to make a separate peace with the United States so long as the other was still fighting. Sure enough, such a request was received by Ribbentrop on the 18th. He agreed in principle, fearing that otherwise Japan might reach a compromise with the United States. For the next week, the reports reaching Hitler were conflicting. Then, on November 28th, he received a telegram from Hans Thompson reporting that Cordell Hull had handed to the Japanese what amounted to an ultimatum which is bound to result in the immediate breakdown of all of the talks. Quote, end quote. Hitler discussed the implications of this with his staff, then sent Ribbentrop to inform General Oshima that if Japan did reach a decision to fight Britain and the United States, they must not hesitate, as it would be in the Axis interests. Oshima inquired in puzzlement whether he was to infer that Germany and the United States would soon be at war, and Ribbentrop replied, "Roosevelt is a fanatic. There's no telling what he'll do." Ribbentrop then gave the Japanese the assurance they had wanted. If Japan becomes engaged in war against the United States, Germany will of course join the war immediately. The Führer is adamant on that point. Ribbentrop does seem to have had doubts. On the train carrying them both back to East Prussia the next day, November 29th, he asked Hitler what Germany's posture would be if Japan attacked the United States. Hitler cast diplomatic niceties aside. If Germany welched on Japan in the event of Japan's attacking the United States, it would be the end of the Tripartite Pact. The Americans are already shooting at us, so we were already at war with them. Yeah, that makes sense. Some days passed before Hitler's attention was again called to Japan, for he was virtually incommunicado, touring his army headquarters on the tottering Eastern Front. Only then was he shown the latest telegram from Tokyo. The Japanese had again asked for Germany and Italy to stand at her side. Tokyo's secret instructions to Ambassador Oshima in Berlin were couched in even plainer terms. He was to inform Hitler and Ribbentrop confidentially that war between Japan and Anglo-Saxon powers might be ignited quicker than anybody dreams. Oshima saw Ribbentrop forthwith on December 2nd and again the next day. But the foreign minister had to prevaricate because he could not reach the Führer. He evidently managed this late on December 4th. That night, he asked Rome to approve the German counterproposal for an agreement, and at 4 a.m. he handed to Oshima the agreed text of a German-Italian-Japanese treaty. This more than met Japan's requirements. Japan's requirements. Our view, Ribbentrop cabled to his man in Tokyo, is that the Axis powers and Japan regard themselves as locked in one historic struggle. Hitler's eyes were, of course, elsewhere. As winter closed in, barbarous fighting erupted everywhere on the Russian front, where the army's all-out assault on Moscow was beginning. The fight was of unexampled savagery on both sides. A captured Russian battalion commander related what happened to three Waffen-SS soldiers in his area. Quote, when the regiment's commissar Zukanin of the 508th Infantry Regiment asked an officer what he was fighting for, he replied, "For Hitler!" So the commissar kicked him in the groin and shot him. End quote. Autopsy reports revealed that Russian troops defending the beleaguered Leningrad had resorted to cannibalism. Oh, shit. German corpses found behind Russian lines lacked parts of their bodies, although the uniforms nearby were undamaged. The harsh winter took its toll. While the Luftwaffe and SS were adequately provided with clothing for winter warfare, the German army's meager winter supplies were still bottled up by the chaotic railroad system at Minsk and Smolensk, far to the rear. German locomotives, external gossamer of plumbing and pipework, made them easy prey for the sub-zero winters. Instead of 17 supply trains a day, each army on the Leningrad front was lucky to get one. Instead of 18, Guderian's 2nd Panzer Army was getting only 3. When at last winter clothing did reach the fighting troops, it was useless against the Russian winter. Many weeks earlier, Brauchitsch had paraded before Hitler a dozen soldiers outfitted with the army's special new winter gear. Only now did Hitler learn that those dozen outfits were all the army had. Meanwhile, his armies were trapped in blizzards outside Moscow and were slowly freezing to death. Oh man, that sucks. The reverse suffered by the 1st Panzer Army at Rostov on the Don was a bitter pill for Hitler to swallow. An intelligence report confirmed that his own original strategy was that was what the Soviets had feared most. Marshal Timoshenko had just delivered a secret speech to the Supreme Defense Council in Moscow. Quote, "If Germany succeeds in taking Moscow, that is obviously a grave disappointment for us, but it by no means disrupts our grand strategy. The only thing that matters is oil. As we remember, Germany kept harping on her own urgent oil problems in her economic bargaining with us from 1939 to 1941. So we have to do all we can to make Germany increase her oil consumption and to keep the German armies out of the Caucasus." The Red Army, end quote. The Red Army's task now, he said, was to overthrow the Germans back just far enough, was to throw the Germans back just far enough to destroy the caches of tanks and ammunition it had built up for the Caucasus offensive. How Hitler must have cursed the General Staff for having foisted its Moscow campaign onto him. With winter upon him, he had no option but to see it through, although the army's reserves were at an end and the physical conditions were brutal in the extreme. How far the army faithfully called his attention to these adverse conditions is controversial even now. The two army group commanders Bach and Rundstedt believed that Hitler was not being told the blunt facts. "We must face the melancholy fact," Guderian wrote privately, "that our superior command has overreached itself. It didn't want to believe our reports on the dwindling combat strength of our troops. It made one fresh demand after another. It made no provision for the harsh winter, and now it's been taken by surprise by the Russian temperatures of minus 30 degrees Fahrenheit. We in the army have to put up with the horrifying bungling and aimlessness." This lack of civil courage was first brought home to Hitler by the immediate sequel to the loss of Rostov. Kleist's frantic warnings about his long exposed left flank and the severe icing conditions were withheld from Hitler. When Kleist was forced to withdraw his spearhead, intending to fall back on the Mies, Hitler had, on November 30th, vetoed this. Rundstedt, the army group commander, was told to order Kleist to defend a line 5 miles forward of the Mies. In the course of the evening, Brauchitsch received Rundstedt's uncompromising refusal. Quote, "If my superiors have no faith in my leadership, I must ask to be replaced as commander-in-chief," end quote. Hitler sacked Rundstedt the same night. Hitler backed this order with a personal visit to Kleist's battle headquarters at Mariupol, Zadanov, whatever, on the Sea of Azov. He took no general staff officers with him, just his adjutants. He had intended sacking Kleist, but SS General Sepp Dietrich, whose SS Lifeguards division had been in the thick of the fighting, pluckily defended his superiors. Schmutz told Hitler that Kleist's chief of staff had now shown him copies of the Panzer Army's frantic signals before the Rostov operation. These messages had accurately predicted this very outcome. Hitler was astonished that they had been withheld from him. He exclaimed, quote, "So the Panzer Army saw it all coming and reported to that effect. It bears none of the blame then," end quote. He telephoned Jodl's staff in this vein on December 3rd. Kleist's Panzer Army bore none of the blame for the Rostov crisis. Clearly his messages had been suppressed by the General Staff. Thus Hitler's confidence in Rundstedt was restored, though characteristically of Hitler, the dismissal remained in force. Yeah, he can't have his... He discusses that in Mein Kampf, where he can't start going back on decisions he makes or it ruins his credibility. The Rostov setback paled into insignificance against what now occurred at Moscow. General Kluge's powerful Fourth Army had begun its push on December 1st through the forests and swamps of the capital. On December 2nd, fighting through snowstorms and blizzards, a reconnaissance battalion reached Khimki on the very outskirts of Moscow, but it was driven back by the armed Russian workers. This was the German army's trauma. Moscow was being evacuated. Its streets and public buildings were being mined for demolition. Yet by December 4th, with the temperatures 6 degrees below 0 Fahrenheit, both Höppner's tanks and Kluge's infantry were at a standstill. Guderian, visiting the battlefield, found his tank crews still optimistic. But Field Marshal von Bock warned the OKW that his troops would soon be able to proceed no farther. Quote, "If the attack is not called off," he warned Jodl, it will be almost impossible to go over to the defensive." End quote. On the 5th, Guderian, up at the forefront of his army with the 296th Infantry Division, realized that his own attack was hopeless too. His chief of staff recorded in his diary, quote, "25 degrees below zero this morning, tank turrets frozen solid, frostbite taking heavy toll. Artillery fire has become irregular as gunpowder evidently burns differently." End quote. As the hours passed, the temperature sagged to 35 degrees below zero. On December 5th, four Soviet armies opened their counterattack north of Moscow. Next day, 10 more armies fell upon Bock's exhausted and frozen troops. Thus, the real emergency began. The Luftwaffe was grounded. Gasoline fires had to be lit up in pits under the tanks to thaw out the engines. The telescopic gun sights were useless, and every caliber of gun and cannon jammed. The Russians used special winter oils and lubrication techniques, and now their formidable T-34 tank appeared en masse, with its armor impregnable to the standard German 37mm anti-tank shell. Quote, "From the depths of Russia, undreamed of masses of humanity were hurled against us," end quote, recalled one OKW staff officer. Quote, "I can still see the situation maps of the next days and weeks, where until now the blue of our own forces had dominated the picture, with the enemy's red only sparsely sketched in. Now from Leningrad right down to the Sea of Azov, thick red arrows had sprung up on every sector of the front, pointing at the heart of Germany." End quote. Meanwhile, the paraphernalia of modern war congealed into frozen impotence. If battle casualties were not dragged under cover, they were dead within half an hour from exposure. On the 9th, one corps reported 1,500 cases of frostbite. 350 men had to have limbs amputated. 1,100 army horses perished every day. Oh. Quote, "In wave after wave of densely packed soldiers, the enemy offensive rolled across the snowscape toward us. Our machine guns hammered away at them without let-up. You could not hear yourself speak. Like a dark and somber carpet, a layer of dead and dying stretched across the snow in front of us. But still, the masses of humanity came on at us, closer and closer, seemingly inexhaustible. Only when they came within hand grenade range of us did the last of these attacking Russians fall to our machine guns. And then, as our gunners began to breathe again, there was a fresh stir in the distance, a broad, dark line on the horizon, and it all began again." End quote. Thus, a German officer described the rearguard actions north of Moscow. Man, that must have been fucked. Even a healthy commander would have quailed inwardly before such an onslaught, but Field Marshal von Brauchitsch was already a sick man. On December 6th, he tendered his resignation. Hitler replied that he could not agree to any change at this moment. Brauchitsch left the room without a word. Who could replace him? Colonel Rudolf Schmundt urged Hitler to become his own army commander-in-chief. Hitler said he would think it over. In fact, he had already begun to act the role, or rehearse it. By early December 7th, it was obvious that the corps holding the embattled salient at Tikhvin was in danger of being encircled. Hitler decided to abandon the city, which was ruined anyway. He did not consult Brauchitsch at all. Halder sorrowfully wrote in his diary, quote, "The commander-in-chief, Brauchitsch, is barely even used as postman now. The Führer deals over his head with the army group commanders direct. The terrible thing is, however, that the high command does not grasp the condition our troops are in, and is relying on patchwork operations where only bold decisions can be of use." End quote. Toward midnight that Sunday evening, December 7th, 1941, the buzz of conversation was stilled as Hitler's press chief, Otto Dietrich, burst in. Hitler rasped irritably at him, but saw that Dietrich was waving a paper. The British press agency, Reuters, had just announced that the Japanese had launched an airstrike at the U.S. fleet in Pearl Harbor, Hawaii. Hitler joyously proclaimed, quote, "The turning point!" He bounced out of the bunker and ran through the darkness, hatless and unescorted, to show the news bulletin to Keitel and Jodl. To Walter Huell, he rejoiced, quote, "Now it is impossible for us to lose the war. We now have an ally who has never been vanquished in 3,000 years, and another ally," referring to the Italians, "who has constantly been vanquished, but has always ended up on the right side." Even without formally declaring war, Hitler issued to the Admiralty orders that German submarines and warships might forthwith open fire on American ships as and where they met them. He phoned Goebbels to announce that he was coming to Berlin. Before he left for the capital on the evening of the 8th, he discussed at length with his staff how best to declare war on the United States so as to make a good impression on his own people. In Washington, the mood was reported to be grave. Late on the 8th, the west coast of the United States was panicked by a false air raid warning, followed the next noon by an alert on the Atlantic seaboard. Hitler scoffed some weeks later. Roosevelt declares war. He drives pell-mell out of Washington because of air raid dangers onto his estate, then back to Washington. He makes the whole country hysterical the way he goes on. That was a Hitler quote. I forgot to quote-unquote it, which I'm going to start doing now consistently. I should have been doing it the whole time. The Führer arrived in Berlin at 11 a.m. Quote, "He is filled with joy at this fortunate turn of events," end quote, recorded Goebbels after visiting him, meaning Japan's surprise attack on America. Quote, he was taken completely surprised and, like myself, at first didn't dare to believe it, end quote. The Japanese had adopted precisely the right tactics. Quote, "The Führer is rightly of the opinion that in modern warfare it is wholly out of date, even medieval, to issue an ultimatum. Once you make up your mind to defeat an enemy, you should wade right in and not hang around until he's braced himself to take your blows," end quote. To Hitler, this was the delicious moment when he could deliver to that lout, Roosevelt, the public smack in the eye he deserved. Late on the 9th, Germany instructed her Washington embassy to burn its secret files and code books. The foreign ministry furnished Hitler with a list of all Roosevelt's violations of neutrality. Shortly after 2 p.m. on the 11th, Ribbentrop read out Germany's declaration of war to the American charge in Berlin. Now President Roosevelt had the war he had been asking for, he concluded. Yet deep within, misgivings were gnawing at the Führer. Major von Below, who had met him at the railroad station, found him uneasy about the long-term consequences of Pearl Harbor. Ribbentrop also professed later to have been distraught at the manner in which the Tripartite Pact had been drafted to keep the United States out of the war, had now brought her into direct confrontation with the Reich. Speaking to the Gauleiters on December 12th, Hitler admitted he had spent several sleepless nights chewing over the decision whether to declare war on Roosevelt or not. He dismissed the German army's difficulties on the Eastern Front as, quote, "an unavoidable hitch," end quote, and he hoped that the Western plutocracies, quote-unquote, reluctant to lose their possessions in the Far East, would now fritter away their forces around the globe. Despite the strategic benefits, Hitler was heard to mutter, quote, "I never wanted things to turn out like this. Now they," meaning the British, "will lose Singapore," end quote. After he had returned to the Wolf's Lair with the Barbarossa campaign on the brink of its first winter crisis, he made to Walter Huell this remark, quote, "How strange that Japan's aid we are destroying the positions that with Japan's aid we are destroying the positions of the white race in the Far East, and that Britain is fighting against Europe with those swine, the Bolsheviks," end quote. Oh, that was a chapter.